From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
My first ghosts. I had seen my first ghosts long before Mrs. Hartnell told us her story of Oxenby. This was as a young boy in Ireland, in the old house where I was born, in the 70s, the son of a Church of England country vicar. I was just 5 years old, and had been put to bed at my usual hour. But on a long summer's day, the sun was still shining and the light came through the drawn blinds, preventing me from going to sleep. As I lay on my side trying to relieve the boredom of my own company by counting the spots on the counterpane of the bed parallel with mine, the door handle suddenly gave a little click. I glanced round and saw that it was being very slowly turned. Wondering who was outside and thinking their slowness in entering the room was from a belief that I was already asleep, I watched the slowly moving handle with casual interest. Gradually, very gradually, the door opened, and when at length it had opened, perhaps a couple of feet, an extraordinary figure suddenly shot into view, and taking up its position against the wall just inside the room, stood and regarded me with the greatest intentness. It appeared to me to be about 6 feet high, that is to say, about the same height as a certain tradesman who came regularly every morning for orders and whom I had heard said was a good 6 feet. I also thought the figure looked very strong and powerful, but the extreme length of its arms and the massiveness of its head, which was disproportionately large for its body, gave it a grotesque look that was considerably increased by its being nude and covered in places with large yellow spots. Its eyes were yellowish-green and sphinx-like. There was nothing in the face to denote the thing's attitude towards me, whether hostile, friendly, or merely indifferent. It stood staring at me fixedly for some time, and then, turning round, walked out of the room, closing the door noiselessly behind it. It had not menaced me, so I was not frightened. When I spoke about it in the morning to my mother, she told me I must have been dreaming. It was not until several years later, after her death, that I learned for the first time that the house was haunted, and that other people besides myself had seen strange, inexplicable shapes in it. My next encounter with a ghost occurred just 4 years later in Wales, at the Devil's Bridge near Aberystwyth. One August afternoon, I was descending the steep pathway leading to what is very appropriately known as the Devil's Punch Bowl, when looking behind me, I saw a tall, shadowy figure suddenly bound across the track and disappear into the dense foliage. In shape, it closely resembled one of those old-fashioned wooden Dutch dolls. It had the same kind of thin, long arms and legs, which appeared to move all in a piece in a perfectly round head, somewhat too small for its body, owing to the shade from the trees and the speed with which it moved, for it simply flashed across the pathway. I could not see its features very clearly, but I was left with the impression of a mere caricature of a human face. It did not seem in any way evil or antagonistic. Later, when traveling back to Aberystwyth with some friends in the wagonette we had hired for the outing, I mentioned the incident to the driver and asked if he could in any way account for it. "Well," he replied, "they do say around here as how the valleys of the Rheidol and Manneck are both haunted, more particularly perhaps the Punch Bowl and the old Devil's Bridge itself. I can't say that I've ever seen anything there myself, but my father used to say he once saw the Canlu Kirth, or the corpse candles, on the old bridge the night a farmer friend of his in the valley died. And my grandmother declared she saw the phantom funeral procession cross the new bridge over the gorge the day before one of her sisters was buried. I had another experience of a Welsh haunting only the following year in Penmawr, where I was spending the summer holidays. I was awakened one night by the most extraordinary noise. It was like a loud flapping of wings and was accompanied by a curious croaking and groaning. The sound seemed to come from the street. My bedroom was in the front of the house, and after continuing for some minutes, they abruptly ceased. In the morning, I described what I had heard to our landlady, and she said, "It was the hag of the dribble." My husband and I both heard it, and Mrs. Thomas over the wayside beating its wings against the window frames of her room and looking in at her. One of her children is ill, and she says she is sure it was the hag of the dribble. Come for the boy in that he won't last through the day. She then went on to explain that the hag of the dribble was a strange shadowy form resembling in one part a dreadful old hag with a skull-like face and gleaming eyes, and in the other part a monstrous bat. She said it only haunted people of genuine old Welsh extraction and never came to them except before death. If it was heard merely to flap its wings and groan, it portended the death of some more or less distant relative of the family it haunted. But if it was seen looking in at the window or heard calling anyone by name, then it portended the death of the person named or one of the family in the house. I asked if it was usual for other than relatives or members of the haunted family to hear it, and she said, "No, unless they have Welsh blood in them." I then told her that I had a strain of Welsh blood in me, and she replied, "Then I've no doubt you did hear the hag of the dribble in the night," adding with a look of grim certainty, "that Thomas child will be dead before morning." And sure enough, what she said was true, for late that evening we learned that the Thomas child, who had been ill for some time, had suddenly taken a turn for the worse and was dead. I had another unusual experience a few days after this. I was walking one afternoon with my old nurse along a lane near Penmawr when I noticed a solitary willow growing by a pool on one side of the road, swaying about in a very peculiar manner. Although the day was piping hot and there was no wind, the tree shook as if in the throes of a great storm. I remarked on the sight to my companion, but she did not reply. Instead, she turned very pale and quickened her pace. It was not until we had got back to town that I could prevail upon her to say a word, and then only by much coaxing. However, when the landlady came in to lay the tea, my old nurse's tongue seemed suddenly loosened. She told the landlady of the walk we had taken, and asked her if there was anything wrong with the willow growing by the pool in the lane. "You mean the lane running in the direction of Langdon?" our landlady asked. "Because they do say it's haunted. One or two people have from time to time been found drowned in the pool, and there's a story about some old tramp hanging himself on the tree. Anyhow, the spot has had a bad name, and the people around here don't care for passing it after dark, especially if they're alone." "Well," said my nurse, "I don't need to be told that the tree's haunted, for as sure as I'm alive, I saw a skeleton in a winding sheet sitting on one of its branches, and it was he that made the tree shake. He was swaying to and fro and laughing at us as we went by." I might state here that, interested as I was in having had, at this early age, perhaps more than my fair share of encounters with the supernatural, I certainly had no ideas of pursuing the subject, nor was I particularly interested in ghost stories, for I was inclined to be as nervous as the next person of such things. There was, however, much more in store for me. From preparatory school in Clifton, I went on to spend 5 years at college. I then went for a time as a pupil on a farm in Scotland. spent 2 years with an army crammer in Clifton, and then went and read for an inspectorship in the Royal Irish Constabulary at the Queen's Services Academy, Dublin. It was while I was thus occupied, living in rooms in Upper Leeson Street, that I had my first experience of what I might justly term a dangerous ghost. I had retired one night, a little earlier than usual, for I was very tired and had just got into bed when I heard a slight noise coming apparently from one of the window recesses. Glancing quickly in that direction, I saw something stir. I had put out my candle, but the moonbeams filtering in between the folds of the thick plush curtains that hung across the windows illuminated the room sufficiently for me to see, though not very distinctly, any large object in it. And now, as I stared in wonder, and I admit, not a little fear, I saw something rise from the floor and advance towards me. In the dim light, it was too vague for me to describe accurately. I can only say that it gave me the impression of being something very sinister, something only partly human in form, and wholly antagonistic. It advanced so quickly that before I had time to move or utter a sound, it was gripping me by the throat with long, clammy fingers and pressing me backwards, down, 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 until my head finally touched the pillow. I gasped, choked, and suffered the most excruciating sensations of strangulation, but there was no relaxation. The pressure from those deadly fingers continued until I eventually lost consciousness. On coming to, I found myself alone. The thing, whatever it was, had gone, but I was far too terrified to move, and it was not for some time that I ventured to raise my head and look around. The dawn had broken and it was quite light. Just to satisfy myself that no one could have got in from outside, I got up and examined the door and windows. The door was locked on the inside, just as I had left it before going into bed, and the windows were bolted. I got back into bed and lay there trembling until I was eventually called. My landlady raised no objections when I asked to be moved to another room, and after much persistent questioning on my part, she finally admitted that the house, and particularly the room I had occupied, was haunted. She told me that the house had once been a private home for the mentally afflicted, and that according to rumor, someone, either one of the patients or a nurse, she did not know which, had died in that room under extremely tragic circumstances. Not surprisingly, I was totally unable to sleep in the other room to which I was moved, and so I left the house and found quarters elsewhere. It might be thought, with some justification, that such an experience would have cured me of any further curiosity regarding ghosts, but it did not. When I heard that a locality in the Wicklow Hills, near the junction of four crossroads, was reputed to be fairy haunted, I took a room in a cottage close to the spot, intending to hold a night watch at the crossroads. On my arrival at the cottage, feeling tired after a long cycle ride, I decided to hold my first vigil the following night and went to bed early. The night was so beautiful, however, that before undressing, I leaned out of the window of my room and drew in deep breaths of the clover-scented air. The view was compelling. Before me, gleaming white in the moonlight, lay the crossroads, silent and deserted, a scene that so fascinated me that it took an effort to tear myself away from it. But I eventually did so, and having gotten to bed, was soon sound asleep. I awoke with my heart pounding. No sound disturbed the stillness of the night, and I was pondering over this and comparing the silence of the hills with that of the city I had just left, when I suddenly caught the sound of footsteps in the far distance. It was someone running with long, even strides, and as the sounds drew near, I became aware of something about them that was both unusual and disconcerting. On they came, sharp and well-defined, nearer and nearer still, until they were quite close to the cottage. Then a dog in the yard at the back of the premises set up a mournful howling, and I heard Mrs. Mullins, the wife of the owner of the cottage, the couple occupied a room close to mine, say, "John, do you hear the dog?" "I should be deaf and make no mistake if I didn't," her husband replied peevishly. "What's bothering him?" "You may well ask that," Mrs. Mullins retorted. "Listen." And as she spoke, I could hear the footsteps crunching their way up the gravel path to the front door. There they stopped. It then struck me more forcibly than before that there was something peculiar about them, something that made them different from any other footsteps I had ever heard. But what exactly that something was, I could not for the life of me say. "John," Mrs. Mullins began suddenly, "I don't like those footsteps. Who and what can they be? It's the first time I've heard anyone running along the road, past the crossroads too, at this hour. And what can they be doing in the garden? Do get up and make sure the front door is locked." She had hardly spoken before there came a loud knock, to be speedily followed by a second, and then, after a brief interval, a third. I heard the husband get up, shuffle his way to the front door, and inquire who was there, but I did not hear any reply. Curiosity prompting me, I got out of the bed, and going to the window, which almost overlooked the front door, peered out. To my astonishment, there was no one to be seen. In front of me lay the fields and crossroads, with the gently sloping hills beyond, all sleeping peacefully in the brilliant moonlight. No sign of a caller, and yet I had heard no one go away. In the morning, after I had finished breakfast, Mrs. Mullins asked if I intended to stay any longer, and when I said that I had changed my mind and had now decided to leave that afternoon, she showed unmistakable relief. "Did you hear anything in the night?" she asked. "Only someone knocking at the front door. There was nothing the matter, I hope?" "Why, no," she said, with a queer expression in her eyes. "Nothing the matter exactly. But my husband and I didn't like what we heard in the night at all. We have never heard footsteps like those before, and we believe they came for you. I should have been obliged to ask you to go, if it hadn't been that you have said you will go yourself." And she fingered the edge of the tablecloth nervously as she spoke. "I don't understand," I said. "Who was it that knocked? And what makes you think that they had any business with me?" "It wasn't anybody," she replied, "because when I looked out of the window, no one was there. It was a spirit, sir." Here she crossed herself solemnly. "And it has something to do with you." Seeing that she was so very serious, I then told her of my experience with a strangling ghost in Leeson Street, and she expressed the opinion that it was this ghost that had followed me to the cottage. "And County Galway, where I come from," she said, "they believe that ghosts sometimes attach themselves to people and follow them about. I only hope and trust this one will never do you any harm, and that you will speedily get rid of it." Well, I left the cottage that afternoon. Even if the woman had been willing for me to stay, nothing would have induced me to do so, for whether she was right in her theory about the footsteps or not, I could not endure the thought of another night near those forlorn crossroads. One other incident occurred during my stay in Dublin. I was very fond of fishing and often spent Saturday fishing either at Dalkey or some neighboring spot. On the last of these fishing expeditions, I engaged a boatman to row me to the Mugglestone Rocks, which lie a little beyond Dalkey, and on arriving there told him to row back to shore and come for me again at 6 in the evening. It was about 11 a.m. when I first threw in my line, and all the time I fished that day I had the curious sensation that someone was standing at my elbow watching me. I could feel eyes following my every movement, yet when I turned round to look, which I did several times, no one was there. The island consisted entirely of bare rock, affording no cover of any kind, so that had anyone been on it, I should most certainly have seen him. Now, as a rule, I had no cause to complain of poor sport, but I could not catch a thing that day, and I was glad when the boatman turned up earlier than expected at 4 o'clock to row me back. I asked him, nonetheless, why he had come 2 hours before his time, to which he replied indignantly, "Well, that's a queer question to ask. I came because you signaled me to come." "But I did no such thing," I said. "Where were you?" "Why, I was rowing about," he said, "some little distance off, and happening to look in the direction of the island, I distinctly saw you wave your handkerchief at me, which meant you wanted me to come." And all I can say is, if you didn't stand up and wave a handkerchief, then the ghost did. This very matter-of-fact allusion to a ghost struck me as being distinctly comical, and I laughed outright. Consequently, it was some time before I could persuade my would-be rescuer to say another word. But he got over his annoyance after a time, explained to me that some years previously the body of a drowned sailor had been washed up on the island, and that a figure believed to be his ghost had frequently been seen there since. "Have you caught anything?" he asked suddenly. When I told him no, he immediately cried out, "I thought so. When the ghost about, no one ever does." It was after this latest odd experience that I resolved to learn more about ghosts and hauntings purely to satisfy a personal interest. Having failed to pass the medical for the constabulary, I left Dublin to carve out some other career for myself. Ghost hunting would have to be very much a spare time occupation. But when, after a long working tour of America followed by spells of acting and school teaching in Britain, I gradually became known as a writer, so my activities in the ghostly field increased, until I came to be positively identified as that rarity of the time, a ghost hunter who did not rest on his own stories alone, but who also went out to investigate and record factually the experiences of others.